Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Game Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rudolf Enders, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Harald Koberg, the author of a Game Studies publication from 2021 called Freies Spiel or Free Play. The publisher is Büchner in beautiful Marburg, Germany. Before we jump right in, though, I want to let you know that if you like our show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the audio platform of your choice, and share this episode with your friends. And now back to the show. What needs are satisfied in digital gaming, and what does the shift of these needs satisfactions into the digital space say about the social realities in which they are embedded? We hopefully get rock solid answers to these and more questions right now. Harald, welcome to the show.
Welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Harald, I wonder if you kick things off by telling us a bit about yourself and your line of work.
Yeah, well, as you've heard already, my name is Harald Koberg, and I studied philosophy and cultural anthropology in Graz, which is a city in Austria. And throughout my studies, I also worked as a reviewer for the federal government of Austria, because they were looking for games they could recommend to parents and grandparents that would not just be okay for the children to play, but that would really be recommendable for them. And that was my first step into a theoretical thinking about digital games. So throughout my time at university, I was already somehow working in the pedagogical field around video games. And from there on, I continuously tried to get beyond that and to get a possibility to keep working in that field. And after doing a few talks and workshops here and there, I got the possibility to build up an own branch for digital games at a local NGO called Ludovico. Ludovico was focusing on play in very many different forms, but pretty much just analog forms of play, on culture of play, but also on the pedagogics of play. And I got a funding in order to build an own branch there for digital games or for digital play. And that's what I've been doing since 2012. Which also ran alongside my master's and PhD studies. So I started to try to connect the different fields. I tried to be the one who understands the fascination of digital games, but at the same time knows the research and understands the sorrows and thoughts of the pedagogues. And what I did there was that I conducted a lot of workshops, talks, but also just pretty much very simple gaming events in order to get all these people together. So I try to view myself as pretty much a mediator between the players, the pedagogues, but also the research. And I kept on doing research until 2020, pretty much. I'm still doing research, but I'm not any longer directly bound to or directly connected to a university. So in cultural anthropology, I did both my master's and my PhD thesis on digital play or on video game culture. My master's thesis was focused on the discussion around video games and violence, of course, not trying to answer the big questions whether that would be dangerous for the people who play or whether they might become more violent through playing games. That was not so interesting for me, but I was interested in how this discussion was led and how the dynamics work there. So that was my master thesis. And then in my PhD thesis, I focused on the questions that are also asked in this book we're talking about today. So I focused on the question of why do people play, what do those games mean for them, and what impact do they have on the social worlds they live in. Yeah, and maybe one last step that is pretty relevant, I guess. I also work for the local government right now, where we broadened the topics I'm working on. So there I'm not just focusing on digital play or on video games, but I'm working there as an expert for digitalization and society. So I'm trying to discuss and work on this intense field of, or this intense question of what digitalization does to society, how does it change the way we communicate, how does it change the way we get our informations and we interact with our informations. So that's, at the moment, that's the second big part of my work. And now and then I'm still teaching at universities or at schools, focusing on either one of those two big fields.
Right. And just came across my mind that not only you're the first guest from Austria, which is pretty exciting, but it's true. We have met last time. We have seen each other, I think, at Frog. This is a conference in Austria, and I really witnessed there that you're an excellent speaker. Very impressive talk you gave. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's true. Circling back to Freies Spiel, your book, please tell our listeners, you have talked about a bit, but now let's get to the nitty-gritty. How did you come to write Freies Spiel in the first place then?
Well, the book is very much based on my dissertation, so on my PhD thesis. But I wrote the thesis already with the book in mind. So I tried to get to the to be very open about the way I write this scientific text in order to make it interesting for people to read, because my goal was to write a book that was an academic book, of course, but that could be read by people who are not from the field of cultural anthropology, and at the same time by people who might be into cultural studies in some way or form, but who might not have any knowledge about game studies or video games. So from beginning to write this thesis, I was trying to make it very readable. But after finishing my PhD, I still put some work in and tried to make it easier to read and better to understand. I added some comments, especially for people who might not know the terminology of the different fields, in order to make this book interesting and readable for people from all different aspects of life who might be interested in reading it. So what I basically did was that I, after finishing my thesis, I went on to look for possibilities to publicize it, and happily Büchner Verlag is more and more interested, as I am witnessing, and as you have witnessed, and you've been an active player there too. They're very active in supporting game studies books and bringing out game studies books. And by now they have a pretty great list, I think, of books and authors on the issue. So that's a great chance for people of German-speaking countries to publish their game studies texts and books.
Yeah.
One thing that might was of course interesting is my two supervisors for the PhD thesis. One of them, of course, came from cultural anthropology, and the other one came from my second studies from philosophy. And she wrote in her report that she was quite surprised that it's okay to write like this in the cultural studies, but she still thought that it's a great text and an interesting text. But I think that tells a little bit about the way I wrote the book, that of course it tries to bend the possibilities you have within academic writing in order to make it interesting to read for everybody who might be interested.
Yeah. Funny enough, two observations here. You're definitely right. I mean, the situation around publishing houses in regards to game studies in German-speaking countries is, or at least in Germany, is getting better and better. So no comparison to, let's say, the situation 10 years ago. That's for sure. And what's also funny is that I was just about to ask the exact same thing. How did your supervisors react to your plan to get it more reader friendly? But it's a funny story that you just were mentioning. Oh, I'm really surprised. That's the way one can write also this book. Let's see. It's funny.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the great things about cultural studies, and especially cultural anthropology. It's being the way it's being taught in Graz, that they have a very open approach to academic writing and also to the way of academic working. So I think that's a field where you get great possibilities to do things like that, and to be a little bit more detached of the chains of classic academic work, which usually or quite often turns out to be very hard to read for people who don't come from that exact field or from that exact part of work and part of academic part of the academic world.
So this also sounds like you could definitely recommend Graz as a hotspot for future game studies scholars if you want to let's say be not less rigid in your endeavor in academic sense, but to have a certain kind of research freedom topic wise and also in your tonality.
Well, I think in Graz we have the same problem that many of the German-speaking universities I know have, that there is nobody really officially related to game studies issues. There's no institute for that, and there are just a few people here and there working on these subjects. So I think what you need to do is to find a field that you want to work in and find the institute to do it. But I think that the institutes and the professors are being more and more open towards the issues. I know that around the time when I started writing my thesis, other people told me, yeah, I wanted to do something on game studies, but my professor said that that's just not a thing we would do. And I also had these difficulties searching for funding for my thesis, that people told me, well, your institute and your professors are not into game studies, so why do you think you're at the right place to do it? But at the same time, I believe that there's a lot of liberties and a lot of freedoms here in order to work the way you want to work on these issues. But you have to find them for yourself, and pretty much you have to create them for yourself.
Yeah. people and their voices. This gives me the opportunity to actually circle back to your book now. Now, what's really great about it is you let gamers themselves have their say and follow their traces of the described fascinations and passions for gaming, the act of gaming and games. So as far as I understand, it is not only about stories and interactions with the game, but also about the rules and limits of communication, about spaces of unfolding self-dramatizations and norm setting. Would you agree to my reading here, and what is your take?
Yes, I would agree. And I would say that my primary interest in video games is what they do with the players or what they mean for the players. So I'm very much interested in the player's perspective, and I conducted very open qualitative interviews asking players to tell me about their lives with video games. So it was pretty much biographical. I asked them, what did you play at which time of your life? Who were the people that were somehow connected to playing games? So where did you get your games from? Who motivated to play these specific games, or how did you get them? For many people, in the beginning, they just played whatever was there and then got into being informed about what games are out there and trying to find them. But I was also very interested in the reaction of the people around them, so who might have been criticizing them for playing the games, and which reactions they got when they talked about their hobby or when people were confronted with them playing video games. So this was a very open approach, and I think one of the things that pretty clearly came back was that people talked very little about narratives. So while I believe that a big part of game studies is still very much focused on narratives and an analysis of narratives, and also, of course, the analysis of game dynamics, when you talk to the players, that's not the core things they're talking about. For them, it's a social thing. It's making experiences, usually very closely connected to other people. And that does not just mean multiplayer and online games, but also when they play on their own, they feel that through playing this game, they are connected to a huge number of people around the globe who are also playing these games. So That were the dynamics that I was very interested in, and that became more and more interesting for me while conducting these interviews and looking for theory that fitted what I experienced when talking to the players. And that also led me to getting a feel for this very hard to grasp world of digital play, because Jesper Juul, for example, he writes about video games as them being half real, which is, I believe, part of the truth. They are not real, but they are real in some way. So I guess most of us in game studies have moved beyond this idea of a very narrow magic circle where things that happen within the game have no impact whatsoever on the world around them. We pretty much know now that this is not the way things work. Games are not just a way of evading realities, but they are enlarging our reality. And of course, the different realms of reality, as I might call them, they are in strong interaction with each other. And that's where it starts to get interesting. And that's where players start to tell you interesting stories. Because, for example, when telling you about their play, they often jump between first person and third person when they talk about what is happening within the game. So sometimes they say, well, now I'm walking down that corridor. And one moment later, they would ask, why can't he open this door? And both of the times they're talking about their avatars. And sometimes they even talk about the game designer saying, I don't understand why they wouldn't let me open this door. Yeah. So there's a lot of reflection of what is happening there, that there are many people, many different people connected to what is happening here, and many different people have an influence of on what is happening here. And that's where video games, I believe, gets so fascinating, because they open social worlds for us that work differently than the social work worlds of our everyday lives. But at the same time, of course, they are closely related to them and in strong interaction with them. And that's what makes them so fascinating for the people who play them. And of course, that's not the first thing they might tell you when you start to ask them about why they play, how they play, and what fascinates them about playing video games. But when you get into talking and when you let them talk, then you will find a lot of stories. And that's what happened to me, that make you realize that these shifts between different, you could call it ontological states or different realms of the real, that's where things get very fascinating for the players. And I think that's one thing that hasn't been in the focus of game studies very much up to now. Of course, there are some people doing similar work as I am doing it. But I think a lot of focus, as I said, is still on the gameplay and the narratives. And I think that there's a lot, an awful lot to be found when we take a closer look at the players and the way they actually interact with the games, the way the games interact with them, and the way their play interacts with the bigger social context around them.
Yeah. Well, it's really exciting. I was just thinking about the way you were mentioning when players, for example, as you were mentioning, talk about why couldn't I open up that door, that specific door. And it's also exciting to see whenever, and this is something I can obviously observe while I'm playing on my own, I feel like I used to tell people I did this in the game, but whenever it comes to failure, for example, I tend to project it into the third person, because obviously I wasn't able to make that jump. So, but when I talk about it, of course, why can't this just damn fool not hold on to this rooftop or something like this? It's not why couldn't I do this? Seconds before, I was talking about the total identification of the player, character, and myself. But in the moment of failure, I just push it gently away, so that's not my responsibility anymore. And to me, that's a clear sign of the actually the it's a proof even or soft evidence that this is me at the moment. But if it's not going the way I want it, it's suddenly not my mistake anymore. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, and there you're pointing towards one of the big ideas or big theories of my book and my thesis, because I believe that this is one of the exact dynamics that help people to cope with the things they experience within the game. So, for example, I work a lot with teachers and parents, and they tell me that young people these days cannot cope with not being able to do something. They get frustrated very, very, very quickly, and they always blame everybody else if things don't work. And then I ask them, well, now it's a little bit in decline, but a lot of them are playing Fortnite, and Fortnite means that one person wins and 99 people lose playing this game. And those same young people, those same youngsters, they can perfectly cope with that in Fortnite. Of course, they get angry every now and then, but they love to play this game. So video games have this power to make these experiences more pleasant and more interesting and more motivating for us. And that is, I believe, very strongly related to what you have been telling us right now, that at every given moment, they get the possibility to choose how much it's them and how much it's the game that makes things difficult for them. And at the same time, they get to choose how serious they want this game to be. That's what Jesper Juul, to come back to him, is calling the emotional gamble. He says the more emotionally invested we get into a game, the more we can get out of it, but the more it might hurt us if we don't turn out to be successful playing the game. So when I try again and again and again, and I put a lot of work into the game in order to be able to do it, then it's being harder and harder for me to stop trying because I know that I've invested so much. But at the same time, I can always pretty much stop it and say, well, it's just a game. There's no need to get angry about it, and try to pull myself emotionally back out of the game. And that's something you can also witness when you watch people playing games. At Ludovico, the NGO I'm working at, we also have these opportunities, these afternoons, where we just have consoles and PCs there, and people can come and play video games. So I have a lot of opportunity to just be there and watch them and listen to what they do when they play games. And one of the reoccurring dynamics that are there are people provoking each other, trying to connect their failure in the games to their personality. So they say, how dumb can you be that you won't be able to do this within this game? Mm-hmm. And they try to get people angry, connecting the gameplay to their individual skills. But at the same time, at the point where the players get too angry and might throw around the controller or shout back at the people talking to them, then they say, why are you so upset? It's just a game. You're a bad player if you can't disconnect these two things from each other. Mm-hmm. So that's also a game that players, a meta game that players play while playing games, that they know that it's not totally a real thing, but at the same time, it's real enough to be connected to our individual skills. And that's something people play with. And that is also, I believe, very important when it comes to the bigger social impact of these video game worlds. I one thing that should be pointed out pretty early, I guess, in this talk today, is that I believe it's very important to talk about games as experiences, so as the bigger thing. Yeah. And for me, playing a game also means watching YouTubers, looking for information online, discussing with friends when meeting them about the game, or maybe even thinking about new strategies in the game while you fall asleep. I think that's all part of playing the game. Of course, it's very hard then to draw a line around the game and saying, well, this is the game and this is not the game anymore. That's getting harder and harder the more open your perspective is. But I think from a social point of view, you will not understand the impact and the significance of games if you're just thinking too narrowly about the moments when we actually sit in front of the screen and play the games.
Yeah. I wonder how does this connect, because you also write about insecure masculinity, and I wonder how do you connect the dots here? Is there any connection? Is it an obvious connection, or is it something you had to really dig deep into the layers of sociality, basically?
Well, I think when you do research the way I did it, it's not unusual that it becomes very obvious to think about masculinity. Mm-hmm. Because it's something that comes up in the interviews and it comes up in the experiences of players. Of course, very strongly when you talk to female players, because they have their experiences with masculinity in playing spaces. But also when you talk to heterosexual men playing video games, because they will tell you about the needs that are satisfied by the games. Some of them more reflected, others maybe more naive about what is happening there. But for example, people told me, you know, I'm quite critical about these ideas of heroism and saving the world, one person saving the world, but there is some urge within me of wanting to be that and wanting to be that hero. And it's a beautiful thing that I can do it within video games. So one interviewee, for example, he said, you know, I would love to change this world. I see so many things that need to be changed, and I'm also trying to change them. But in the physical life outside of the digital, it's very hard, and you get very rarely you get positive feedback trying to change things. So even though I know within the video games it's not the real thing, I still experience it to be very very interesting to me, very nice for me to have these possibilities within the games. So that's one of the points where you pretty clearly see that there's an aspect of masculinity when it comes to playing games. But of course, and I think that's the more relevant part, when you look at gaming communities, at the way people communicate while playing games, and of course at the bigger issues, dynamics like Gamergate and what came from it, it's pretty obvious that there is a lot to look at and a lot to think about. So your question was whether that was connected to what I said before, and I think it's very closely connected, because what people do when they use video games as spaces of doing gender and of trying to live up to very specific ideals of masculinity is that they use this half real aspect of games, because many of them are faced with inner conflicts. They live in an everyday world that ask them to be men. So we're still living in this world of hegemonic masculinity where social hierarchies are very closely connected to ideals of masculinity, and the closer you get to that ideal, the easier it will be for you to move up in the social ranks. And of course, there are many people who don't succeed at doing this. And for them, especially for them, of course, for the others too, but especially for them, it can be very interesting to move into these digital realms, because video games offer everybody who plays them a form of empowerment. And this empowerment, in many cases, in most of the games, I would argue, very strongly caters to very traditional ideas of masculinity, of heroism and of dominance, of fighting the others and living in a world where one person needs to stand the ground and fight everybody who's being there against them. So for people who are pretty unsure of how to deal with the whole issue, whether they want to criticize these patriarchal structures, or whether they want to be successful within them, video games offer the possibility of not really having to choose, because I can experience a game as pleasure and play it, even though I might be quite critical about it. And if I'm, for example, acting aggressively masculine within a gaming space and I'm being criticized for that, I can always take a step back and say, well, you know, it's just a game. I'm just provoking within the games, and that's not the way I am, and that's not the way I want to be. And the very interesting thing is, since we get to choose at every given moment, as I said, while playing the games, how serious, how real we want it to be, we can even use this to deal with our own insecurities. And if you move one step further on to the real toxic spaces of Gamergate forums and so on and so forth, there you get this in their whole idea of argumentation. You will find arguments that are very enraging for people, and where they're confronted with a lot of pushing back, because they're so extreme in their positions. But they always jump between putting out these positions and then moving back and saying, well, if you're getting angry about it, you just don't understand the internet. It's just fun and games. It's just about the laughs and the giggles within the internet. We're all just trolls trying to provoke you. Yeah. So it's this game of provoking the snowflakes. But at the same time, of course, they are being very serious about the things they say, but this digital realm of play gives them the possibility to move back and jump back out as soon as the pressure against them is getting too strong for them. So there, I believe we have this very strong connection of how game worlds and worlds of play work, and how these political dynamics within gaming spaces work. A lot of these people have moved into the gaming spaces because they felt to be under pressure in trying to live up to their ideals of masculinity outside these gaming spaces. So video game spaces gave them the chance to get closer to these ideals. And now for a few years, they have been criticized within these spaces for the way heroism and masculinity is lived there. And that, of course, turns their whole defensive dynamic against the people attacking them, because it's pretty much putting the finger on the wound for themselves. Because, of course, when moving into the digital realms, they know that this is not the real thing and that they can be successful here, but this does not mean that they are successful or that they are being perceived as successful people everywhere else. So they know it's this half real thing. And when people confront them with this dynamic and put their finger on the wound, then of course you get big emotions exploding.
Yeah, maybe this has also something to do with my next point I wanted to talk about. You write that digital gaming culture and the debates that surround it, as you're clearly showing in your book, are a significant arena of social power struggles for interpretive and decision-making sovereignties in an ever more rapidly changing world. Could you please deep dive a little bit more into that argument for me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since we have been all around this argument for the last minutes, I'll try to build it up very, very, very quickly. When I did my first interviews, my first big surprise was how strong stigmatization was still connected to video games. So, of course, people tell you that video games have reached the center of society and that they're mainstream now and a part of pop culture. And that's true on the one hand. But on the other hand, if you talk to the people and ask them who they talk to about playing video games, for example, they will tell you that's not something they talk about on the first date, or that's not a hobby that they will tell their boss when they try to get a new job. That's just something that you keep to yourself. And especially adult players, if you ask them about the people they talk to about their games, it's pretty much other gamers. So it's a thing that it's a bubble that contains its issues within itself, because many of these people have made the experiences that when they talk about playing video games in big parts of their free time to people who don't play games, then they are confronted with these old stereotypes of that being antisocial behavior and so on and so forth, of them being violent maybe, or at least glorifying violence. And since they don't want to have these same discussions again and again and again, they just keep to themselves and talk to other people whom they know of that they like to play video games. So that was one of the first things I found when I started my interviews. And I thought, well, there's quite a big price still to pay if you play video games, because you're confronted with all these dynamics of stigmatization and of stereotypes. So why would people do it? On the other hand, of course, there's also a lot of time and money being invested in the hobby. So there needs to be an output for them. And that's when I started to ask about or to look for their motivations and to look for the needs and longings that are being satisfied for them within the games. And this issue of masculinity was one of the topics that I found, one of the motivations I found for people playing games. And there were some others that I'm talking about in the book. And what I realized was, well, they have these needs and longings, and because they don't find good opportunities to satisfy these needs in other parts of their everyday life, they move into the gaming worlds and the worlds of digital play, even though they know that to some extent this is not the real thing. As I tried to sketch using this this idea or the thinking about masculinities. So they know it's not what they it's not the real thing. It's not what gets them the success they wanted to have outside of the games. So still, they use the games to satisfy these needs and longings. And that's where I started to ask myself, well, why are these satisfactions being pushed into the digital realms? And what does that, again, tell us about the social realities around them? And that's, I believe, where it gets very interesting, and not just on a very theoretical academic level, but also when it comes to the bigger, broader discussions about video games. Because for example, when we talk about young people spending so much of their time playing video games and evading realities, then that is usually in the broader media, it's very strongly connected to very harsh criticism about the medium of video games. But quite rarely the question is being asked, well, why do they feel that they have to run away from their realities, or why do they move away from their everyday lives into the gaming worlds? So even when it comes to these everyday or broader discussions about digital play and video games, I think this thinking about why these needs and the satisfaction of these needs is being moved into the digital realms could help us to move on with these discussions and get away from just blaming the medium, which didn't help for the last 30 years and won't help for the next 30 years to come.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, most definitely. Well, we are entering the final round now, so to speak. This is where I'd like to ask my guest for a little meta reflection. So firstly, what aspects and ideas would you have loved to include in your book, Freies Spiel, that did not make the cut? And secondly, and I'm really excited to ask that one, where do you see game studies as a research field in general at the moment?
Well, thinking about the first question, of course, there were some little things that I took out in order to make it one whole of a book, that I stopped following. I think one aspect that is very interesting, and also, yeah, it's a deep dive in theoretical thought and also philosophical thought, but I think it could, if you make the round, it could get very interesting thing for people thinking about the bigger social impact or the bigger impact of digital play, is using post-humanist theory, which is getting stronger and stronger throughout the last years, and should not be confused with transhumanism, which is trying to enhance human possibilities or human lives through digital or technological means. But posthumanism is pretty much a critique of the humanist idea of the human being the center of the universe and everything evolving around them. And I believe that within this theory, it's a big field of theories that are being summarized as post-humanist, but these theories help to understand why we as a global society or as humanity have have fallen into so many crises throughout the last year. So for example, if you talk about the climate crisis, then that is, of I think, pretty obviously very closely related to the human being too clearly in the center of our thinking and not thinking about other actors and the relevance of a dynamic of other actors within this global system. So why I believe this is interesting for game studies is because post-humanist theory is trying to dissect the idea of the individual and see all the different actors that somehow build up what we then experience to be our subjective individuality. Mm-hmm. And I believe that amongst all the people out there, video game players of video games are the closest to really experiencing that in what they are doing. Because as we've been talking about it earlier, if you think about the language people talk about their people talk about them playing, they jump between these different actors. And even though they might not really name them, they might not talk about the designers, but as I said, when they say, "I don't know why they won't let me open that door," then they know that the avatar is not just their representation within the game, but it's also in some way the representation of the ideas of the designers. So we could also argue that the avatar is a tool of communication between the player and the game designers. And you could also say that it's a point of contact between the social context of the players and the social context of the game designers. So of course, the game designers can only come up with games that somehow are in the fields of the thinkable within their social realities. And at the same time, the player needs to be able to understand what is happening there and what the game is asking them to do. And since the game is an interactive medium, they need to be given opportunities to somehow choose what they want to do within these games. So when we think about the avatar as the individual or as the hero of the game, people, some of them more openly and some of them more subconsciously, realize that it's not just them choosing what this avatar can do and what he or she does, but also many other factors that are factoring into that. So I believe that the post-human experience that is at the moment a very theoretical thing and construct led by a small bunch of great philosophers mainly, this experience is very closely related to the gaming experience. So when if we think or if we believe, and I think that there's a great lead there, if we think that we can get into new ways of thinking about the world through post-humanist thought and through a new understanding of our existence in this world and what individuality means and what a subject is, then making this experience within playing video games could be very interesting and is maybe the most practical thing we have when we think about that. So I think there's a very strong connection there where we really could get into the utopian hope of the video game experience helping us to solve the big problems of our times. So that was your first question. So I would love to have included more of this, but it was just by far too much. It could be a second book or a second thesis, and there's a lot of work that needs to be put into that. Your second question was
did I hear the word habilitation?
No, not at the moment. I'm not connected to a university at the moment, so I don't know of possibilities of writing a habilitation without being connected to university. And at the moment, I must say, I'm pretty happy that I'm not working for a university, because and that's pretty much a connection to your next to your second question, that I believe the academic field, in the way it's being more and more neoliberalized, is very difficult to work with, especially when you come from the humanities. Because if you have a pessimistic point of view, I would say that academic work is reduced to numbers, how many publications you have, and how many how many theses you wrote and so on and so forth. And I think that just doesn't tell us anything about the quality of the work. And especially when it comes to humanities, if you start asking, well, what's that for and where can you publicize that and is it relevant enough, then you won't get very far. And especially you won't get very far within game studies, because of course there's this big critique of that being so relevant for our world. Do we really need to delve into that? So I think, and that's something, especially in the bubble of German-speaking game studies scholars, throughout the last 1 or 2 years, we've seen quite a lot of people moving away from universities because they just didn't get the opportunities to do their work there. Mm-hmm. And that's why I personally am pretty happy that I'm having that I have found occupations that give me the possibility to keep on doing theoretical work, but very closely connected to practical work. And I think I have more freedoms, even more freedoms in research right now than I would have at a university if I would not be able to get a big funding for a big project where I get to do whatever I really want to do. Yeah. So I don't think it will be a habilitation very soon.
Well, Harald, we have talked about this at the aforementioned conference as well a little bit, and it's really a tricky situation. Lots of game research actually is really happening on private accounts and in private times because there's no real institutionalized place for us. Now, speaking, see me air quotes. It's a tricky situation. Maybe it's getting better. Definitely. I hope. I'm really hoping for it, but well, we'll see.
And I think just to give a small note on my view on the state of game studies right now, I think that there's also a lot of potential in there because the fact that it's a network of people that are somehow connected to some institutes, and often they are pretty much the only people in there. In their closer academic surroundings that are focused on these issues. And I think that brings out a lot of creativity and a lot of different perspectives on the game studies. So I think that there is a lot of creative potential coming from game studies not being institutionalized. But at the same time, as we've discussed right now, it's quite problematic because many people don't manage to stay in academia because there is no institutionalized game studies possibility for them. Of course, there are some institutes and some universities that are doing something there, but it's still quite, there are still not so many possibilities out there. So I think on the one side, it would, of course, be good to somehow unify this idea of game studies, also of course from a scientific point of view, to get a clearer picture of what game studies is and what might be research on digital games but not game studies and so on and so forth. And of course, especially when it comes to institutions, it's easier when you know that there are these 5 or these 10 institutes in the German-speaking world where I can try to get a job. But at the same time, I believe that when it comes to the creativity of thinking and the freedom of thinking, there is also some positive potential when it comes to this scattered network that we have right now, and that brings out a lot of great interactions and a lot of great thinking and books and publications. So I think it's a lively field and a lively network, and I love the way we are being connected and getting into discussions across disciplinary borders and so on and so forth. But yeah, I would of course also hope that there might be more institutions, more institutes, more universities who somehow see the possibilities there and do something for the game studies. That would be great for the future.
Yeah, we've taken a lot up of your time now. So let's bring this house down, so to speak. What are you working on right now? And of course, what will you be playing next?
Well, at the moment, I'm finishing a new book, which is not an academic book. So I'm trying to piece together all the things that are in this academic book that we're talking about today, and mix it up with my experiences from my work and from my everyday interactions with video games and their players and their parents and their teachers and their youth workers and so on and so forth, and to write a more easy to read book about the whole issue, and I'm just finishing that at the moment. It will also be published by Büchner Verlag in the next year, I hope. And yeah, so that's the big project I'm working on right now. And the second question, what am I playing? I just started to play God of War.
Ooh.
I finished Horizon Forbidden West and played quite some Sifu in between. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to catch up on a lot of games that I'd love to have played throughout the last year. But I'm also the father of a 1.5-year-old son. So my play time is quite limited at the moment. So I sometimes just pick up a game, play it for 1, 2, 3 hours and then put it away again just to get an idea of what it is and then move on to the next one, because my possibility to play games for hours and hours is at the moment a little limited.
I see. Well, kids, you gotta love them. Well, that sounds like a great project, and I'm very eager to find out more about this book, and maybe we will join a regroup and talk about that book as well then. Let's see. For now, I want to thank you for being on the show today, and I really enjoyed it. So take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much.
So, dear listeners, I hope you liked this episode. If you're an author and or an editor in the field of game studies or game research yourself and want to talk about your latest publication, please do not hesitate to contact me under rudolf.inderst@googlemail.com. Alternatively, please send me a direct message on social media. You will find me under Rudolf Inderst almost everywhere. In the meantime, please check out our other Game Studies podcast episodes on the New Books Network. And that's it for today. See you in a bit.